Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 260. My name is Cameron English, your host as always, joined by Dr. Liza Dunn, ER physician, toxicologist, space host now. You're branching out, all kinds of cool stuff. How are you doing, Liza? It's good to see you again.
I'm doing well. Happy Easter.
Yes, happy Easter to everyone out there. Hope you had a wonderful time at church and with your families and whatever you were doing. And let's talk about some science. We got some cool stories today. Increasingly, we're talking about these crazy genetic technologies that aren't slowing down. So we've got another story about that, but a couple others that we want to talk about first. So first up, diet weed. More than 10% of high school seniors take loophole legal drug Delta-8 THC. What are the consequences? Next up, coming era of cattle farming. Genetically engineered dairy cow produces human insulin in milk. And finally, the radical conservative case for genetic enhancement. Oh boy, that'll be a fun one. Okay, Liza, this first story is interesting, and given your background, I'm really excited to talk about this. This is by a physician named Akshay Sayal from NBC News. I totally butchered that name. I'm sorry. But again, it's called Diet Weed. More than 10% of high school seniors take loophole legal drug, Delta-8 THC. Okay. So as far as I understand, Eliza, this is like the knockoff, the bootleg of like Delta-9. Like there's the there's the cannabinoid that gets you super high, and that's why everyone smokes pot. But then there's this other chemical that's closely related. I guess it's not as potent, and you can get it in hemp as opposed to marijuana. And so in a handful of states, I guess there's quite a few states that have legalized marijuana, and so this isn't a problem there. But in states where it's still technically illegal, people are consuming Delta-8 instead. And there's this weird loophole in the farm bill. Maybe you can talk about that. But essentially, because hemp plants are legal to grow and to consume the products of, people can get this. And so if you go to, you know, a pot shop or any of these kind of like, what are they called? You know, smoke and vape stores, like these kind of places, you can get Delta-8 gummies and all this. And of course, NBC and some, you know, people at the FDA are concerned because this is essentially unregulated. And so this is sort of the angle for the story, is there's this hip new thing on the market, and high school seniors, being the crazy kids that they are, they're curious to try it. And we don't know what it's going to do to them. And then there's the typical speculation about depression and anxiety and mental health issues that, you know, we just need more evidence, essentially, before we can answer this question. So what did you make of this?
Yeah, I think it's actually kind of one of these things that you see kind of flash every once in a while, but it's a newfangled kind of new drug. I don't know if you remember back in the day when bath salts were all the rage and things like that. So this, when it's funny, when the press points it out, all of a sudden everybody's like, this sounds like a kind of cool thing to try. I might give it a shot. So I don't know what's better, talking about it publicly and you know, getting everybody wound up about it, or, you know, trying to manage it a little bit more conservatively. I don't know. But long and short is Delta-8 THC is a psychoactive substance. It is actually not found in very high concentrations in traditional cannabis, right? Cannabis sativa. But it is found actually in the hemp plant in higher concentrations. And hemp is generally thought, generally not used for its psychoactive properties. So hemp has been able to be sold without the same kind of regulation around it that cannabis with Delta-9 THC has been able to be sold. And so it makes for a very, very interesting issue, because kids are like, maybe I can get around this. Or people are there, like, maybe I can, who want to make some money, maybe I can get around all the regulation around Delta-9 THC and go ahead and sell this because it's psychoactive. Now, the problem is that really people don't know that much about Delta-8, right? We know a lot about marijuana. We know a lot about marijuana medically and Delta-9 THC effects the way it works, but we don't know a lot about Delta-8 THC, and they haven't been evaluated by FDA and approved. We don't know what the side effects really are. We do know that there has been an uptick with several thousand people admitted to the hospital or evaluated at the hospital for side effects, which include, you know, altered mental status, nausea, vomiting, and a variety of other things. In fact, there's been one pediatric death actually reported from getting into this. So since it's not been adequately evaluated by FDA, and we don't know a lot about the physiology and pathophysiology of how this chemistry works, you really want to be pretty careful about, because it does have psychoactive effects. It is intoxicating. And then there's no regulation in the way it's actually produced, like the way it's actually extracted from the plant itself. So it's, I don't know that anybody knows how, I mean, people know how to extract chemicals from plants, but I don't know that anybody knows what's happening in somebody's little kitchen where they may be making methamphetamine too. You never know, right? What they're using to extract this. And so the safety of the chemistries and the residues that those chemistries leave on the final product is unknown. And I mean, where does this kind of go bad? Well, this kind of, if you want to take the example of MPTP, which was an adult, which was a contaminant of a opiate that was manufactured in an illicit lab in California. They were making a version of meperidine, and it got contaminated with MPTP, and you wound up with people with sudden onset, very severe Parkinson's because of this exposure. So you really want to be careful about how you're making and how you're extracting your final product. And that requires a regulatory process. And once again, this is not regulated because of this loophole in the Farm Bill, right? So the long and short is we don't know enough about it. There aren't any trials. We do know it can be intoxicating and has caused a pediatric death. So I think it's very important for people to keep this out of reach of kids and maybe not use it as an alternative version of Delta-9 THC, which I actually think is being oversold and overused anyway. I think that there are some mental health effects associated with Delta-9 THC that people are pointing to as being concerning. And so the widespread use, the promotion to children in gummy bear forms or whatever sounds very reminiscent of what tobacco companies were doing in the past. And I think it's going to be a very interesting space to watch going forward.
Yeah, it's a fun area, because one thing you'll see is that a lot of people who are pro harm reduction when it comes to heroin and pot and like any of these illicit substances, they are adamantly against smoking or any product that contains nicotine, which is always really funny to me. So like, yeah. So they're like, you know, this mild stimulant we've been consuming for centuries, we can't have it because of the children. But then, you know, Cheech and Chong can sell Delta-9 gummy bears on Twitter.
On Twitter, which is just, it's kind of mind-blowing. Yeah, it's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And the other thing about harm reduction, I mean, it's funny to me that harm reduction applies to things like heroin and other things, but harm reduction in terms of cigarettes, you know, vaping is a form of harm reduction. So yes, there were some side effects and things like that, but I'm confused, let's just say, about how this gets translated in public.
Yeah, it's a wild story, and it makes no sense, because with tobacco harm reduction, you can actually take the elements that are deadly out of the product and leave the stimulant that people enjoy and the method of delivery that they enjoy. That's why it's so effective. But when it comes to like, no, you can still do heroin. We're just going to make sure that there's no contaminants in it or that there are fewer contaminants. So, right. Yeah. So if you overdose, I mean, that's bad, but at least you won't get HIV. You know, it's like, right. like the scale of risk and benefit is just totally warped. But I do want to say one thing that we need to be careful of is that NBC, any news outlet will do this when they're talking about drugs and our beloved teenagers who never do anything wrong. They're always the victim, don't you know? This is actually use of this drug based on, it's called the Monitoring the Future Survey. And this is one of the many, not many, it's one of several surveys that the federal government maintains to kind of keep track of what the state of public health is. And there are some that look specifically at kids. So there's one that the CDC does called the National Youth Tobacco Use Survey. And monitoring the future is a little more broad and includes drugs. So this is basically, it's self-reported survey data from teenagers. So they ask high schoolers, how much of this do you use? According to that survey, they say nearly 31% of high school seniors reported having used marijuana in the past year, and more than 1 in 10, so 10%, yeah, reported having used Delta-8 THC. And this is a survey of about 2,000 kids. So these are relatively small numbers. I'm not downplaying youth drug use. I don't think it's a good thing for the reasons you outlined. And maybe you can mention scromiting as well, which is just a horrifying concept, but it's a real thing. You can tell people what that is in a minute. But nevertheless, I just want to stress that although we need to be aware of this and that we probably need some sort of regulation around this, it is quite rare. And the thing, and there's some interesting research on this, one of the things that almost guarantees that kids will try a drug is if the media blows it up about why kids, yes, shouldn't use a drug. You know, yes, that is one of the, like, we've, you know, there's so many examples, but I think that's very, very important. And like those drug-free commercials in the 90s where you had like talking fish and people talking about your eggs or your brains are like a fried egg, you know, like,
yes, like, this is your brain. Yes. This is your brain on drugs.
Yeah. It's like, they're so cringe and so embarrassingly stupid that your kids are like, well, this must be badass if they're running dumb government commercials about it. So all that to say, right now, it's actually relatively rare. So as a society of responsible adults and public health regulators and so forth, one of the best things we can do is turn the volume down, turn the temperature down, and stop blowing it up like it's a crisis, because that is what will make it a crisis.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned scrounging, because scrounging is a combination of screaming and vomiting at the same time, and it's associated with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. So people who smoke marijuana frequently will have the syndrome of just uncontrolled vomiting over and over and over again. And it and the only way to fix it is to abstain from marijuana. But they enjoy being high, and then they get into this. And it's interesting. It's one of the actual clinical clues about cannabis hyperemesis syndrome is when they take a shower in the hot water, that tends to relieve the symptoms a little bit. So that's one of the kind of things that'll tip you off that's the cause of the vomiting. Because there are a lot of things that cause vomiting outside of this, right? So, you know, pregnancy hyperemesis, that you get lots of vomiting there. You get hyperemesis from other things too. But if that's one of the things that you can ask that will point you in the right direction to somebody who's reluctant to tell you about their marijuana history. Although people are, you know, fairly straightforward these days, since there's not such a stigma associated with it. But I have talked to people who are in ERs since the legalization of marijuana, and they've been seeing more and more of this phenomenon, and it's hard to deal with because you know, people are really, really miserable and really, really sick, and I mean imagine chemotherapy, right? Vomiting. I wouldn't want this syndrome, but yeah, so that's what that is. And I don't know that Delta-8 THC is associated with that. I don't know that anybody knows, but it's definitely a feature, not a bug, of chronic marijuana use, as is memory loss. You know, some people are saying that there's an association between the development of schizophrenia and marijuana use. I'm not 100% sure that is a true causal thing, or if that is sort of unmasking an already pre-existing pre-existing issue. So a lot of, if you think about it, with schizophrenia in particular, it tends to show up in the late teens, early 20s, and that tends to be the same time when people start experimenting with psychedelics or mind enhancing or whatever, however you want to determine what people are saying, but mind altering drugs. And so I think that while there may be some validity to an association, it may actually not necessarily be causal. I don't think we can say that it's causal, but a lot of people are trying to make that association now. And once again, you got teenagers trying Delta 8 and we don't know what it does.
Yeah. So a fascinating topic, no doubt. We'll talk about it more. I think I could solve this. You know, I would love an FDA grant, but if you don't want to write me a check for $2 million or whatever, I think the solution here is it's illegal for kids to do. You need to come up with some sort of guidelines for how it's manufactured. And you need to let people who know what they're doing. That is, you know, qualified chemists, people that understand the underlying science, let them manufacture it, set out some rules that are related to retail sales and online sales. And then you let adults use it that are old enough to use it. And then you study them. And then that's how...
Well, you do a randomized controlled trials, right? The kind of trials that you need for pharmaceuticals.
Right. So do the research, let adults use it. And then when you identify things that are problematic, then you report those to people. And then you enforce any laws that could jeopardize public health. So if there's some idiot that gets high and starts swerving on the road, then you punish that. Or if someone does something violent, then you punish that, right? So I think that's probably the best way forward, because it's so predictable when we deal with drugs, is we find something that's wrong and we either go, no problem, it's totally fine, don't be so judgmental, or we go, you may not have any of this, and then it becomes a giant black market, and then things go wrong.
That's exactly right.
So it's like, there's a happy middle ground somewhere, I think.
There is.
Okay.
There is.
All right, well, we'll leave that there. Go check out the NBC story, but look at the survey data as well, because that's where you get the facts, you know. So use of this is very, very rare. And of course, when they do surveys like this, they say, you know, how many times have you used this in the last year? And I think it was like 68% of the kids said, I've used it about 3 times. So.
Well, and the other thing is with self-reports, and especially with this kind of stuff, the kids are reporting that they've used it, but they may not actually know what they've used. There may be adulterants in there. There may be, you know, it may be a completely different, you know, it may be oregano. they don't know, right? So often, and especially in this kind of thing, when there's something that's completely unregulated, nobody knows.
Yes, more to come. I'm sure there will be a new panic here shortly. we'll get
got to sell the news somehow.
There you go. Right. You can't tell people the truth, so you got to make up stories.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So enough with the diet weed. This next story, this is really, really cool. This is from a great organization. They're called the International Service for the Acquisition of Agrobiotech Applications, or ISA, which is a better name. We'll just call them ISA. But they're talking about a study. This was just published in, what's the journal? It doesn't matter. It's a peer-reviewed journal. They focus the biotechnology journal, simply enough. But they're talking here about, I think it's the first time that this has happened. They took a dairy cow and then bred it to produce human insulin in its milk, which is incredible. Obviously, we're at the very beginning stages of this, but the idea is, and we've talked about this a little bit before, like biofarming, mm-hmm. where like you produce pharmaceuticals in plants. And here, mm-hmm. here's an example of biofarming, but you're using animals. And so the idea is, if you can produce insulin, which is a widely in demand drug for diabetics, you can lower the cost because you can increase the supply of it, and you can do it safely using transgenesis, using technology that we understand really, really well. So I think this is the first case study of that. And again, it's not like you're going to start getting insulin in your whole milk at the grocery store. It's not going to work that way.
No, that would actually have... Yeah.
That'd be bad. You're like, wow, everyone's getting fat and type 2 diabetic. What's going on?
I don't know that they'd even... Well, I'll tell you in a minute, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just going off crazy here. All I'm saying is they're not going to like start putting this in the milk. That's not the idea is you can produce this through traditional means like this, like dairy farming that we understand. And then you can produce Like you'd purify the insulin and then you'd sell it as a medication the way that people consume
it. As a medication.
Now.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. So you wouldn't be, you won't be finding it in your milk. It probably wouldn't work anyway in your milk because you digest it. Right. So it wouldn't, it would be broken down in your, by enzymes in your digestive tract. So it wouldn't treat your type 1 diabetes. Yes. So it would be great to have some kind of oral way of treating type 1 diabetes, but we haven't gotten there yet. This is really interesting. I thought the science was fascinating because you can actually, the way insulin is produced in the pancreas by the beta islet cells, is you've got several steps that happen. The gene, which is a recipe for the insulin protein, is expressed. mRNA goes in and transcribes the recipe for that gene, and meaning it writes it down. So mRNA is like a chef, if you think about it, right? And it takes it out of the nucleus of the cell into the cytoplasm, which is like a kitchen, and then goes to the ribosome, which is like an oven. And it uses tRNAs, which are like sous chefs, to bring amino acids to that oven, and it bakes the protein. And after the protein comes out, the protein isn't quite ready to act. It winds up getting decorated, and then it winds up getting packaged and then sent out to different parts of the body to do its thing. And insulin is supposed to be secreted to act as a key to unlock the door for cells so sugar can get into cells. And sugar, the simple sugar that we use in our cells, is called glucose. But insulin has to go through a couple of cleavages. So there's pre-pro insulin that gets cut, and then there's pro insulin that gets cut, and then it becomes insulin. And that is a biologically active form. What they were experimenting was, it was in the mammary gland of the cow, they were able to secrete this pro-insulin, which was kind of cool. So they genetically modified the cow. They used a virus to bring genetic material into a cell, and then were able to transfer the nucleus of that cell into a somatic nuclear cell transfer, they would transfer that into another cell and then grow a cow. And you could theoretically clone these cows this way, right? And then all these cows could produce this pro-insulin that can then be further cut, and then you could turn it into a medication. I think this is cool science, really cool science, but I think we also make insulin very, very effectively with E. coli. So genetically modified bacteria make human insulin, and they do it very, very well. And I don't know that this will wind up being a reduction in expense. There are some downsides because there are enzymes that are secreted in the milk that can also wind up cutting up the pro-insulin as well. So it's not definitely not ready for prime time. It's a very cool proof of concept paper. Interesting science. We'll have to see where it goes.
Yeah, if anything, I think it illustrates that you can do this. So maybe there's another drug where the economics make more sense.
Yeah.
I guess the insulin example made sense to me because even though we can mass produce it, it's still shockingly expensive for a variety of regulatory reasons when it comes to health insurance and healthcare. But what concerns me about this is that it's awesome, and so someone's going to screw this up, right? The FDA is going to come in and write some idiotic rule. Or like someone's going to ruin this. I'm sorry to be cynical.
Yes. No good deed goes unpunished, right? Right? No good deed goes unpunished. I mean, look at GMOs. Look what happened to GMOs.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe I'm a little too much of a cynic these days. But this is cool. Like the fact that this is possible, you know, because back in the day, I think we've talked about this a little bit. The only way to get insulin was from slaughtered pig pancreases. And it wasn't great insulin.
Pig and cattle.
Yeah. Yeah. So it wasn't.
And there are different, since they're different proteins, you could actually wind up having increasing resistance to it. So you could make antibodies to it, and then it may not work later on. So yeah, there were all sorts of issues with it. Animal welfare, the efficiency of it. This is human insulin's much, much better for humans.
Yeah, I just always, this is the kind of stuff that got me interested in this, is the fact that they can take a human gene and then pair it with a promoter from cows. And that's basically just a genetic switch. So it turns on or turns off a gene or regulates how much of it is, how much of the protein is manufactured. It's super cool. I just love that this is a thing. Like someone figured out that we could do this, you know.
People are so smart. And you know what? You know what's interesting is I do think, once again, we talk about, and maybe this will be a segue into the next article if you're ready, but we talk about scientists. And I think scientists, there is a selection for a little bit of this spectrum in science, because somebody thought about this closely that they were able to concentrate it that hard, I think that it's selected for. And I think it's important for people to be able to have that degree of focus and understanding on to advance science, because that's how we've gotten to, have the, like I said, the 20th century is the most amazing time in history for all of the things that we've achieved. And so when people get very they want to do things to prevent certain phenotypes, certain express, it's, I think you lose something as well. And so I think selecting for a group of people that are exactly alike, you wind up losing a lot of the beauty that humanity has. But that's for the next article.
Yes. Well, it's a great transition. This is a fascinating story. And it's an interesting argument, the approach. I appreciate it. It was a unique way of coming at this issue. So this is called The Radical Conservative Case for Genetic Enhancement. This is by Jonathan Anomaly. I'm not familiar with this gentleman, but he seems to have some sort of a background in bioethics. And he works for, let me get his bio here, Center for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics in Ecuador. And he's author of a new book called Creating Future People, The Science and Ethics of Genetic Enhancement. So check out his work. He's the academic director at this think tank. So it's interesting. But what he's doing here is he's taking traditional, I guess you call them like conservative philosophical arguments, and he's arguing in favor of pre-implantation genetic selection and embryo editing, these kind of technologies we've talked about that are promising for a variety of reasons, but they are quite literally editing the future of humanity, because you're editing the genomes of your children and your grandchildren. And right as soon as you make those changes, they are permanent and there's no going, there's no control alt delete. So there's significant consequences, and he's approaching this from the perspective of the people who might object to this technology. And he's trying to use ideas that they are already sympathetic to explain why this should be okay with them. And I think,
and he's even quoting G.K. Chesterton.
Yes, yes. It's very, very clever. We're going to get into why I think that's a little duplicitous in just a second, but I just wanted to hype him up a little bit. But basically, in essence, his argument is conservatism synthesizing a lot of argument and debate over the centuries here, but in a sense, conservatism is about preserving tradition, and it's about preserving institutions that societies build up over time. And what he's saying here is that you can't preserve, you know, the health of the community simply by being still or being static. In order to preserve, you know, the health of a country or the health of a society, you know, whether it's one country or if it's the entire West or, you know, however you want to define the boundaries, he's saying that when it comes to genetics, over time, a population accumulates mutations that are generally harmful. And part of the problem here is that we've gotten so good at treating sick people that, you know, back in the way, way back days when there was no healthcare and there were no bioethicists or anything, if somebody got sick, you know, they got a busted leg or something, you just kind of left them there, and then the tiger ate them or the lions ate them or whatever, you know, because there was nothing you could do. Right. So it was,
and that's how you got survival of the fittest.
Right. Right. So this was sort of like nature's culling strategy. It's like, who should survive and who shouldn't? Well, the people that get cancer, right. Or the dumb people that ate the berries that they didn't know what they were. Like, that's how you sort of maintain the fitness you know, to use a sexy biology word, like that's how you maintain the fitness of your society. And so what he's saying here is that obviously we're not going to go back to those days, because that, for a variety of reasons, we understand that that's barbaric and it's unethical. We're not going to treat people that way. But nevertheless, what this technology allows us to do, or at least what it could allow us to do, is to modify the genetics of people that might be predisposed to develop, you know, as you said a minute ago, with autism or with some other mental health condition, or, you know, they're predisposed to cancer, or they're predisposed to diabetes, like these things that, especially towards the end of life, take a toll on people and cause them a lot of harm, or could cause them a lot of harm. If we could just stop this, then essentially we're doing what Chesterton talks about in his book, which is we're preserving what we value about traditional society. So it's a very clever argument. I'm very curious to get your thoughts here, Liza. What do you think of this?
Yeah, I think that we don't know what causes cancer. I mean, we know that mutations cause cancer, and we know some things cause cancer, like cigarette, tobacco smoke, that kind of stuff. But we fundamentally, we don't know the series of events that take a non-malignant cell, and whichever cell that's going to be, and then transform it into a malignant cell. And then some people have cancers that become widely metastatic. Some people have the cancers that are fairly indolent. It seems like we're probably having cancers all the time develop in our body that our immune system is able to manage. And once something escapes the surveillance of the immune system, that's when things go awry. Now, that said, knowing who's going to get what kind of cancer from their very first stage as an embryo is out of this world, right? We don't have any way of predicting that right now. No scientifically valid argument for, I mean, I guess you can see if they've got a BRCA mutation, or you can see if they've got, you know, certain kinds of mutations. But for the vast majority of cancers, we have no idea, right? And same thing with the vast majority of diseases. We have no idea what is going to precipitate a long-term chronic disease in somebody. And thinking that you can edit an embryo to be able to prevent those diseases from happening when you don't even know that if that gene is expressed, if it's co-expressed with another gene that makes you less at risk for something else. For example, people who have the cystic fibrosis, right? They wind up heterozygosity for the gene, the one you get from your mom and one you get from your dad, makes people less prone to cholera because their mucus is a little bit stickier, so they don't lose water. The mucus is a little bit stickier because it's a little dried out because this chloride channel is abnormal, right? So if they are less prone to having lots of water dump into their gut, that has a protective effect. Now, unfortunately, people wind up with cystic fibrosis, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't be trying to figure out cystic fibrosis, but since we don't know how genes interact at so many different levels to make the unique person that's you, editing things out on the front end without really kind of having a handle on that may not produce what you want. And so I think that we have to be very, very careful about oversimplifying how beneficial this could be, because I think things are selected for a reason. And like I said, I think one of the reasons that you see Temple Grandin, for example, has a PhD. She's very autistic, but she's transformed the cattle industry because she's able to build, see how cattle perceive being put into these corrals and then going into dipping pools and things like that, where they get deloused, or their insecticide is put on, so they get lose ticks and stuff like that. And she's designed, I want to say, a third or a quarter of the these corrals that, and I'm butchering what she does, but. And it's because of her unique phenotype that she can see this. And she's been very successful. So I hate to bill everything as a as possibly deleterious. And we could do deleterious stuff on the front end without being able to predict the outcome. So I think it's a lot. It takes a lot of hubris to say that this is, we should be doing this all the time.
Very good point. Now, full disclosure, I haven't read this gentleman's book, so I don't know if he deals with this. But
yeah,
Chesterton wrote a lot over his career. And one of the books that I love most of his, it's called Eugenics and Other Evils. And it's in the public domain. You can read this for free online. Highly recommend it. I actually have here my notebook notes. I listened to the audiobook years ago and I took notes because I enjoyed it so much. So what's fascinating to me, and again, maybe he deals with it in his book. I'd love to get him on the show or on one of our spaces to talk about this.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'd be very, very curious. But he doesn't cite the book that Chesterton wrote that's most relevant to this topic. It's called Eugenics and Other Evils. Like,
that's right.
So, and I mean, you can read this yourself, but he takes a sledgehammer to the whole rationale for this kind of thinking, this tinkerer's mindset. Like, I'm going to fix everything that's broken with humanity. One of the points he makes in here that I really appreciate is that science correctly is tentative. Science doesn't have, in the traditional sense, it doesn't have a credo. It doesn't have a dogma. It has guidelines, right? We have a scientific method, but there's no outcome in mind, right? We do our experiment. We try to predict what the result's going to be, and then we see if our results match up with that. Yeah. Chesterton points out in this book, the problem is when you're doing any kind of eugenics or anything approximating it like this technology does, you're running an experiment on the population, right?
That's right.
The creed is, I'll figure it out when I'm done messing with your genes, right? Like this is the problem, you know? So I would be curious, because what he does in the article, which is interesting, is he takes Chesterton's defense of, you know, some traditional moral concept, and he says, you know, you should not destroy this or whatever. You shouldn't take this down before you understand the consequences of it.
Right.
And that's true, but in that context, he's not talking about genetic engineering, not by a long shot, right? He's talking about things that as a society, we've just ripped them out of the ground. We're like, we have no use for that anymore, right? So I think it's fascinating that he takes that argument and tries to apply it to this.
Yes.
But in this book, this is the point he's making, is like, you're basically taking a method of inquiry that's inherently tentative. It can't give you absolute truth, as most people in science will tell you. And you're going, I don't know, like, I have my predictions and I'm going to get peer review and, you know, maybe you'll end up like with three arms. I don't know yet, but like, we're really smart and we're in charge, right?
And we're in charge and we're going to, and it's going to affect a living, breathing individual.
Yes. Yes. Couple other things, and jump in here at any time, Liza, but from this book, there's a couple of things that he points out, Chesterton, I mean. One of the other things he says is that this is inherently vague. So if during the era of eugenics, when it was the sexy thing to do, people were more blunt about what they are after. So they would use phrases,
that's right,
they would use phrases like weak-minded people, you know.
Yep.
So we're a little more precise in our language today, but not that much more. So one of the points that Chesterton makes is, you know, a definition like that, like, you know, we want to get rid of people who are prone to ill health or, you know, mental disorder or criminality, like whatever the end goal is. You can define that essentially however you want. And that's the point.
This is
in the 1920s, I want to say. It's a long time ago. So it's fascinating that he nailed this so much. But he's saying basically people get to experiment on you and they get to define the terms. And if you don't like it, well, right, we have the science. We are the science. So, you know, what are you, anti-science? Yes. Don't be anti-science. It's kind of this. Anyways, I'll stop. Your thoughts?
I think that's exactly right. This is sort of the natural extension of the eugenics movement, because it's like, I'm going to screen my embryos for a variety of things. And obviously it's understandable when it's a deleterious disease, right? That makes sense. And that's how the argument is framed. And people go, of course I can support that. But when you're talking about things that are vague, like, once again, autism, long-term risk of cancer or things like that, you don't know what the impacts are of these things. And you may be selecting out something very, very valuable for humanity without even knowing it. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of you know, not being too risk averse when it comes to doing, you know, scientific experiments, and especially if they're going to benefit people. But if we don't know what the benefit is, I think that survival of the, we may be completely tinkering with survival of the fittest, because we don't know what we're doing. So once again, for diseases and things like that, maybe the diseases that are definable, Huntington's, things like that, maybe that's a valid approach. But for these other things, I think you're playing God.
Yeah. This isn't a direct quote. You guys got me on a Chesterton kick, or this guy did, for writing this article. And it's John Entine's fault for running it. So, but Chesterton says here, this isn't a direct quote, I'm kind of paraphrasing from my notes, but he basically says, if you're free to question the meaning of life, in terms of like whose life is valuable or what kind of life is valuable, then taking a man's wife or his child is no different than taking his beer, right? Like, this is the kind of moral equivalency we're playing with here, is like, once you can edit embryos and you feel entitled to do so, then anything goes. And the point he makes is that once you give the state the final authority of protecting the health of the community, there's no restraint on the law. There's exactly nothing. Right. And again,
that's been repeated again and again and again and again. And people really place a lot of faith in the state. and they sort of forget that what atrocities the state has committed. Look at the Soviet Union, look at Cambodia, look at what happened in all these places. And fascist states have done the same thing. Look at Nazi Germany. To think that the people running the state are motivated by interest in humanity, I think is a little bit misguided. And human beings are human beings. Maybe we could edit that urge out of people.
Yeah. Can we edit the genes that control the hall monitor impulse in people that are in charge? Can we do that? Right. If we can do that, I take back everything I've said.
That's exactly right. If we could edit out psychopathy, maybe.
Right, right. Yeah. If we can edit out whatever certain politicians have, then let's do that. If we can get
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just kidding. I'm not serious about that.
Yes,
but nevertheless, the point he's making is like, if the final check on the state is the state, there is this is how you get right bad places. This is how you end up in.
Yes.
I hate using the N-word, right? And you know, like Germany's been beat up a lot, but like, this is how you get totalitarianism, where really evil things are done. And Chesterton makes the point here that, and he uses the French Revolution, right? In France, in the name of reason, right, in the name of the science, if you will, at the time, in the 17th or 18th century, he says, you know, they slaughtered thousands of people, right? Just dead, you know, and like executed priests, and they turn churches and cathedrals into temples of reason, and like, just an utter bloodbath, right? And it was all done in the name of, we're rational. We have figured this out. We don't, you know, we don't need all of this tradition.
And we're so smart that we would never do anything like that.
Yes, right. Yeah, it's hubristic, as you were just saying. So pump the brakes. I just want to come out and say that. Slow your roll, all right? Because this is bad. This could be very bad.
It could be.
Yeah. And again, I don't know if I said it, but this gentleman, I'd love to talk to him, because another problem I think is that he probably, I'll go read his book, but I'm willing to bet that he won't come out and say, here are the defined standards of morality.
Under which?
Right. Under these standards, we are going to use this technology. I don't think, and he's not alone in this, there are a lot of people that lean to the right today. They call themselves, sometimes they're like, I'm a classical liberal, right? I like freedom and free speech, but they won't actually define what they believe.
Yes.
And you know what I mean? So like, there's no definite standard, because certain things about religion kind of make them feel icky, and they don't want that. And You know what I mean? So I would love to hear him say, you may use this technology under these circumstances for these purposes.
And what are the parameters?
Right.
Yeah.
And so my point is, and again, Chesterton gets at this too. My point is like, he's probably not willing to set the terms because they will almost certainly cause controversy because no one agrees on them, especially today. So anyways, go read Eugenics and Other Evils. Excellent book. So is The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. I mentioned that multiple times. But they both deal with this, and they're old books, and all of these big brains, that's my new insult term, all of these big brains today don't deal with the stuff that these dead guys wrote, you know, 50 to 100 years ago. So
no, they deal with, they're like, no, I've got all my information from X, or all my information from, you know, from MSNBC or whatever flavor of information that's in a soundbite or two.
Yeah, we have the science. Okay, I'm done mocking people. But it's an interesting argument. I do credit him. I think it's a clever approach because when most people come to this, they're just like, you know, get over your weird superstitions. It's a brave new world. It's a great day, and we figured this out. You know, so he's actually making an effort to address the concerns of people. So I appreciate that. Good on him for that. So. One more time, this article is called The Radical Conservative Case for Genetic Enhancement by Jonathan Anomaly. It's on geneticliteracyproject.org. So go check out the website because, as I say every week, they give us this platform. They put the show out. Very grateful to them for that. They are on X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it. They are at Genetic Literacy. We're there too. It's at Dr. Liza MD, at Cam J English. Thank you so much to everyone who's been following us. And thank you for showing up to the spaces. I think we had...
Yeah, come to our spaces.
Yeah, I think you said we had 500 people listening to the last one. That's really cool. So we're taking discrete topics like trust in science, or last week it was Norman Borlaug's work, which is a fascinating discussion. Next time we're going to beat up on the people who think that GMOs or bringing enhanced crop technology to developing countries is the new colonialism. It's the highest level of idiocy today. So we're going to talk about the next time. But show up. You're welcome to chat with us in real time. It's a lot of fun.
Yes, and ask questions. We'll bring you up on stage so you can talk, ask questions. And if you have any ideas for these spaces, let us know. And we're going to be holding them on Friday afternoons. We'll be sending out things on X platform and invitations from X. So join us.
Yes. And not everyone disagrees. I'll stop talking after this. But that's important. We had a mix of people last time. Lots of different perspectives. This is the way, as the saying goes. This is how we make the world better, as we talk to each other and we figure things out. So thank you.
That's right.
Thank you so much for coming to those, and thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.